Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Nick Payne. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners to Preston FM, that's 103.2. Or hello also to Birmingham Unity FM on 93.5 in the Midlands and Radio Verulam in St Albans.
Julian Parry is back. His subject this week is the proposed closure of our public libraries. Lindsay Hay from Bristol Care and Repair is along. She has tips on how to keep warm. We've had some particularly cold spells of weather recently, and they're not quite disappeared yet. And of course, for a lot of elderly people, those are exactly the kind of situations, when you're not prepared for them, that can kill you or give you hypothermia. So she'll be giving us tips on that. We'll also hear from Zimbabwe on the current situation going on there. We hear some more letters from that well-known author, Robert Louis Stevenson. We've had some already, and we've got a few more for you as a taster for Malcolm Greaves' reading of Treasure Island, coming soon to Dialect. Jess Barks is away, but we have his What's On guide. One of us will be giving you that later on. And our resident poet, Tim Burrows, is here with another freshly penned poem of the week, and that will be coming up later on.
But first, a song to start the show. As we'll be talking about the proposed closure of public libraries, let's play Wuthering Heights, sung by Kate Bush. Wuthering Heights is the only novel by Emily Bronte. It was first published in 1847 under the pseudonym Ellis Bell. The name of the novel comes from the Yorkshire manor on the moors on which the story centres. Wuthering, as a Yorkshire adjective, refers to turbulent weather. The story is an all-compassing and passionate tale of the thwarted love between Heathcliff and Catherine Earnshaw, and how this unresolved passion eventually destroys them and many around them. A truly gothic tale of mental and physical cruelty. Hence Kate Bush's own gothic rendering of the song Wuthering Heights, which we hear now.
Yeah!
Our next guest in the studio is Lindsay Hay from Bristol Care and Repair. Lindsay's here to talk about the ways in which, well, this might possibly seem too late, we can keep warm in severe cold weather. Lindsay, hello.
Hello.
Now, we've come up with this basically on the back of our knowledge of Bristol Care and Repair. We've had to interview people before, and there are still severe cold weather snaps, as there probably might well be likely to be, for the next couple of months at least. And then, of course, people have to prepare in advance for the cold weather for next year as well.
Indeed.
So tell us a little bit, I mean, how have you found the intake or influx of sort of questions about what services you provide have occurred over the past months?
Well, every year Bristol Care and Repair gets calls from older and disabled people living in Bristol who need help with their heating systems. Either they don't have adequate heating or their boilers are broken down, or they just want some advice on how to use their heating systems more efficiently. This year, we have had a long, cold winter, and we've helped hundreds of people in the last couple of months. We may still have cold weather, as you said, so it's really good that people should be able to ring us if they are still experiencing problems with their heating, or it could be, you know, in the next week that their boiler's packed up. There's a whole range of ways that we can help.
Yeah.
If somebody does have gas central heating, for example, and there's a problem with it, we have trusted contractors, gas plumbers, who we can contact that can usually get out to have a look at the boiler straight away.
And in their own way, they're sort of effectively can be lifesavers in some ways, can't they?
Indeed. I mean, I can tell you a few stories where I think we have literally saved lives because people have been living in such freezing cold temperatures. And cold does have a really big impact on people's health. I mean, there are cases of hypothermia in Bristol in this century that really sometimes you feel that shouldn't happen. And it's a shock that older people are found with hypothermia in their homes. But there are cases. I've worked with somebody in Totterdam. Mm-hmm. Actually, she didn't have central heating. She was just using Calagas,
right.
Calagas heaters. And she got ill. She used to go down to the shop and order out the bottles of gas when she'd run out, but she didn't have a telephone. And when she was ill, she just couldn't get to the shop to get some more gas. So she took to her bed and she literally developed hypothermia. Her house was so cold, but fortunately a neighbour realised he hadn't seen her out and about,
right, okay,
and contacted the emergency services.
Yeah.
Then we got involved because there's a whole range of work that was needed on her house before she could come home from hospital.
I mean, I guess, you know, elderly people, particularly being more susceptible to the cold, I mean, they will be more susceptible to this for quite, you know, at least the next couple of months, I would have thought. I mean,
indeed.
It's not actually that warm.
No.
Physically.
No.
Even though it's not December anymore.
No, that's right. It's not just hypothermia that's the problem. If you get cold, you're at a greater risk of heart attack or stroke and falls, and thousands and thousands of people fall in their home every year, and keeping warm and keeping your house warm throughout is one way of avoiding incidences of falls.
Okay, for people who are thinking, well, all right, how can I prepare maybe for next year? I mean, what difference would it make, say, if you are just renting a flat or if you're actually a homeowner?
Well, to date, there's been grants available that people can apply for heating and insulation from the government. Some of those grants will still be available next year. And if somebody wanted advice on how to get a grant for heating or insulation, they could always call Bristol Care and Repair.
Okay, so in either sense, just always ring you up and check out, you know, what you might be entitled
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely. I mean, if people have any concerns about the heating or anything to do with their home, they're more than welcome to give us a call. And I'll give the number out later. But also, if people have a gas boiler, they may find it's cheaper to get it serviced during the summer months when the gas plumbers aren't quite as busy.
Right, okay.
People want advice generally on how best to use their heating systems. Again, they can always give us a call and we'll go out, talk it through with them, how best to heat their homes. Because often people will just have heating on very high in one room and have all their radiators turned off elsewhere, or they may be having to heat the whole house to the same temperature because they haven't got adequate controls on the
radiators.
Also,
I mean, structural integrity in certain sort of lots of old buildings will also have a big effect. I mean, a lot of the heat might just sort of be evaporating at a rapid pace out of the house.
Absolutely.
And not really heating them.
And there's also lots of schemes to help, particularly older people, to insulate their homes. And again, we can give advice on what's around. So there's lots of grants for that in Bristol.
Now, all of this is assuming that they're not in some sort of emergency circumstance. I mean, if they are, you know, on the border of hypothermia and they ring you, what could you do in a more immediate sense?
Okay, if we can't manage to get someone's boiler up and running and we realise someone's going to be left in the cold overnight, then we can provide temporary heaters, oil-filled plug-in radiators, which will keep at least one or two rooms warm. And I mean, some of the temperatures we've had recently have been really extreme, and we really want to avoid anybody having to cope in such cold conditions. So we would deliver the radiator and set it up, show the individual how to use it. So again, give Bristol Care and Repair a call if you've got a problem with your heating.
Okay.
The other thing that Bristol Care and Repair can offer is if somebody doesn't have loft insulation, we have a special scheme to get the loft cleared.
Yep.
Lots of people have kind of collected junk really over the years and maybe can't clear the lofts themselves, so they've not been able to get loft insulation. We can help them with that, and it's a free scheme. And if the person doesn't want their loft to be filled up again, we can take it all away. Or if they do want to keep the stuff,
obvious question, a lot of people might be asking, how are the cuts going to affect you? Is that going to reduce your ability to meet demand?
Well, we do know that we are going to be affected by cuts. We don't know the whole picture yet. So we've made efficiencies over the last year in preparation, and we've made progress on that. But we are in the process of approaching charitable trusts.
Okay, but you don't feel in any immediate sense of danger as such at the moment?
Well, we feel our core services, our first call advisors, who anyone that called Bristol Care and Repair will speak to one of our advisors. That's the safe service. We have our handy person service.
Yep.
Carrying out small repairs and adapting homes, fitting grab rails, ramps.
Okay, so all of those things are still available.
They're still available, yes.
Well, what's the contact details if people want to get in touch?
Okay, call Bristol 954-2222. But we also have a website, so if you Google Bristol Care and Repair, you'll find us.
Okay, and the phone number once again, 0117
954-2222.
All right, Lindsay Hay, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Now, if you are not in Bristol, of course, and you are interested in this, then you may be wondering if there are corresponding local organisations in your area. Well, they do have a national coordinating body, which is called Foundations. The website is foundations.uk.com. So if you go to the Foundations website and you look for the little button that says about home improvement agencies, and you click on that, it will take you to a page all about them, and you can scroll down and it has a search tool, and you can search for the one in your local area. Time for another song now. Still on the theme of books, this is from Les Miserables, or as the English know it, Les Miserables, I Dreamed a Dream, sung by Susan Boyle. Victor Hugo's great masterpiece contains the longest sentence to be found in any novel, well, technically in any novel of multiple sentences, because there is a novel that is just one very long sentence. Fascinating fact there for you. And it was published in 1862. That was I Dreamed a Dream from the musical Les Miserables, which came from the book written by Victor Hugo. As the Egyptian people come into the streets, they're caught in a dilemma. You'll have seen lots of this in the news, of course. Wanting a change of government, but also wanting the system to change, which has favoured the rich Egyptian elite ever since it was a British colony. Through Presidents Nasser, Sadat and Mubarak, Egypt has been plagued with outside powers interfering. I'm joined by Dalek's Tony Gosling to talk about democracy in Egypt. Hello.
Hi, John.
So how does this history, recent Egyptian history, fit into a wider picture of Egypt?
Well, it depends how far you go back. Obviously, you can go back to ancient Egypt, which was basically a slave society. But I think what you're talking about is the 1950s. And before that, it was a British colonial power. It was one of those pink bits on the map where the British were in charge. And so Egyptians haven't really had, something like 100 years or so of literally being run by colonial powers outside. In the 50s, the Suez Crisis effectively meant that the British were no longer the colonial power, and the Americans took over. The Americans took over a lot of oil refineries and things like that in the Middle East as well during the 1950s.
But so they didn't get to colour it red, white and blue, as we coloured it pink as such?
No, and this is the problem, of course, for the people, was that it was just one colonial power replaced by another colonial power.
So what sort of methods are we talking about by which you say America runs things? How do they run things?
Well, they have a great deal of influence over the presidents in Egypt, mainly through the massive amounts of foreign aid that comes into the country. And this is how colonial powers work nowadays, usually is through saying, well, look, here's a massive bribe for your leader if you do as we want you to do. And, of course, the will of the people has really not been expressed by Hosni Mubarak, who is the current president.
Right. So obvious question, what is the view of this from Washington as far as we can make out?
Well, Hillary Clinton, the US state from the US State Department, I think is, if you have a look at her, she's playing it cool. She's saying, oh, there's going to be a smooth transition. But I would imagine behind the scenes, the Americans are absolutely apoplectic, and they're really concerned that, most importantly, that Egypt doesn't turn into another nightmare like Iran did for them, where they have an Islamic revolution and lose control of the country.
Okay, so their methods may be backfiring by the looks of it, do you think?
Yes, possibly. And I think as all eyes are looking at Gaza as well now, because there's a very contentious border with Gaza, and so the Palestinians in Gaza are wondering whether a new regime may take a very different attitude and allow goods and services through into Gaza from Egypt, which hasn't happened up till now.
And in the opposite direction, what ramifications in the region, rest of other North African countries? And I mean, some countries I've noticed have banned marching in the streets. Totally.
Well, it's very difficult to say what's going to happen in all the other countries, but I mean, I'm just really focusing on Egypt. There are different possibilities in Egypt. You may have a benevolent dictator, we may have a puppet dictator of the US, or there may be an Islamic Republic. I don't think it's possible really to tell which way it's going to go right now, but hopes and prayers are with the Egyptian people that they get democracy.
Okay. Well, do we have an instance of any news from somebody who would know a little bit more from the inside of Egypt?
Well, there is a bit of advice from some friends of mine in Somerset about democracy coming up from the grassroots, because this is the problem in Egypt, is it's been top-down decision-making, and what the people want is they want the government to represent them. So to the Egyptian people from Tinker's Bubble community on Ham Hill in Somerset, let's have a listen to an ex-colonial chap talking about how they make decisions from the bottom up, and his name's Mike Zaire.
So who rules this place? I do, he said, and I am God. But I have no authority. You have freedom to think, and freedom to make your own decisions. And that is the way this community has evolved. We do it by discussion. We think about the consequences of our decisions. We make revisions. But most of all, we try to go to principles. And the principles are that they should come up from the roots. That is how a tree grows, and that's how democracy should grow. So let's have lots and lots of roots which they form together and then branch out again. They have a diverse culture with diverse opinions and open opinions and tolerance and love. And I think if we've got nothing else to say about Islam, let's say that the people I know who have moved in those countries, it is that they have said that they have an obligation and a duty to care for every visitor, traveller, stranger. And we don't.
Okay, well, that was Mike Zare from Tinker's Bubble Community in Somerset. And thank you very much to Tony Gosling for coming in.
Antira has recently come back from Mozambique, where she met a guy called David from Zimbabwe. In the course of their conversation, it transpired that the 2000 elections in Zimbabwe may well be postponed. Mugabe, now 86, and rival Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai of the Movement for Democratic Change were forced into a coalition government 2 years ago after a disputed 2008 election, which had exacerbated a severe economic crisis. Change was forced into a coalition government over 2 years ago after a disputed 2008 election, which had exacerbated a severe economic crisis. The Unity government, which also includes a small MDC faction led by Deputy Prime Minister Arthur Mutambara, is credited with stabilising an economy, crushed by hyperinflation and reducing political tension. But the coalition has been hobbled by quarrels over the pace of political reforms, policies and state positions. And Mugabe has said he sees no need to extend the condition beyond the middle of this year. In private, both ZANU-PF and MDC legislators have been lobbying against a 2011 election that will cut short their five-year term for the second time, after the previous tenure ended prematurely in 2008, following a 2005 vote. So it looks likely that Zimbabwe will postpone a parliamentary election that President Robert Mugabe's party wanted by mid-year in order to allow completion of constitutional reforms. Dialect's reporter Anthea Page interviewed David from Zimbabwe in Mozambique about the situation in this country.
David, tell us about Zimbabwe now. What's happening behind the scenes? Are you living there?
I might say yes, but doubtfully. Why? Because as a people, we are coming from a very tough situation. For the past 5 years, things were not okay. You know, there was a drought, which is a natural disaster, which we could not do anything about that. But besides the drought, you know, we're in a political turmoil. Things were not okay in Zimbabwe.
People are saying it's getting better. Is that true or not?
You see, the coming in of Morgan Tsvangirai as the Prime Minister has seen Zimbabwe improving in some areas, though we still need a lot of improvement in other things, the health sector, civil servants. We really need to come back to our senses and maybe begin to go again. Because to tell you the truth, from 2007-2008, that was the toughest moment a Zimbabwean wouldn't want to remember. We would go without meal, would go without fuel, would go without basic needs. The supermarkets were empty. And it did not been for South Africa that provided meal, cheaper meal, which an ordinary man could afford. Because, you know, prices would change three times per day. And you'd carry money in a basket in order only to buy two loaves of bread. That was very tough.
People die of starvation?
Yeah. There are some people who died. What I'm saying is people were starving from drought, but not very much. The thing that was causing a very big problem was you could not work for yourself because there was what we call political harassment all over. So you could not fend for yourself, though you would want to do so. I mean, you know, Zimbabweans are hard workers. They wouldn't die from hunger, but because of the political disturbances that were there, that would not allow you to work for your family or to do any business. Because after maybe if you fill up a shop with things, you see people coming, maybe youth, some boys coming and say, we want to eat this. They take things from your shop and you are left with nothing.
Why would Mugabe wreak such havoc on his own people? On the white people, yes, but why the black people, his own people?
Even if you say only white people, I wouldn't believe that, because Zimbabweans are used to coexisting. You know, that's what we are used to. You know, I grew up in the in a scenario whereby Zimbabweans would live together with white people. We had no problem with that, because a human being is a human being, and the world is becoming one village. It's becoming a globe whereby we should live together. There's intermarriage now. There is interaction in schools, universities, and all over.
Yes, but why did he make his own people suffer?
According to him, he was saying he's not making us suffer, but it's because he doesn't want the white people to come back into the country. But, you know, like the squealer and the snowballs in the animal farm, where the milk, the cattle had milk, and there were some windfall apples, and, you know, squealer would say, do you know what would happen if we pigs don't eat those apples? Jones will come back. I think that's what that was the scenario.
He doesn't want to make the country attractive for people to come back.
When white people are about to come back, there is this issue of the diamonds now. I was saying one day, we removed the white people and saying we don't want them to own farms, many farms. But to tell you the truth, some farms are not being used, and some fellow black people are having even 5 farms. I mean, it's replacing a devil for a devil, maybe from a frying pan to the fire. I mean, the same system that we were fighting against is what we are doing now.
So do some people in Zimbabwe miss the white people being there?
Really, 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 very much. Really, especially the agricultural sector, we really miss the white people. You know, they were, I can point at some of the white people who used to do good. You know, there are some white people who used to supply our grain marketing board with a lot of grain, and the farms were taken, and then it's no longer production, to say the truth. If you go there, you are shown things on the surface. You don't see really things, what is happening. We were used to coexisting. That's what we were used to. It's not that the white person was very bad in Zimbabwe. They built schools, they built hospitals, they built recreational places, they built hotels, they built everything. And I mean, can you not miss a person who would have done such good to you? You definitely miss.
Some people in Mozambique, they've said that it was better for people in Zimbabwe because they were given a good education, and the people here were not given any education. Do you agree with that statement or not?
You know, when the British colonized us, they did not colonize us to kill us mentally. They did not disturb even our culture in Zimbabwe. They came in as friends. Thereby, they built good schools. You know, myself, I wrote Cambridge exam. The same exam that a British child was writing in London is the same exam that I wrote. You know, I was at a multiracial school in Zimbabwe. We're sitting, I mean, next on the same desk with a white person. The same education that I was receiving, that this white boy was receiving, is the same education I was receiving, which was an advantage to us. Yeah, we are at a great advantage. You see, no? And that's, I mean, you can hear my English. I am fluent. I have no problem with English at all. Because, I mean, we were taught, we were educated. Myself, I grew up in a white family. You know, they picked me up when my brothers wanted to kill me. I was blind. And they said to them it was an abomination to live with a blind person at home. And they stoned me and they thought I was dead. But praise God to the Pellingtons. Mr. and Mrs. Pellington were there by then. They picked me in a field and kept me since I was 3 years up to A-level.
Are you still in contact with them?
I am trying to be in contact, but maybe because of the political disturbances, I was disturbed because I lost contact with them. In Scotland, I was taking care of the Grahams, and I lost contact as well. Then McLennan, Macaulay, and all that, Hicklin, I lost contact because of the political disturbance. Do you think I cannot miss such people who picked me up at a time when I needed help most? And then someone says, away with them. For what good reason? What about the missions, the mission schools they built? What about the hospitals they built? What about the good roads and the good buildings they built in Harare? Can we not miss that?
Do you see hope again in Zimbabwe? Do you think it will ever go back to what it was?
If we would adopt a policy of coexisting with others, that would do. Because, look, We of late Zimbabwe is engaged in the look east policy and wanting people from the eastern world to come in. It's not working. The things they bring, they are very of cheap quality, no development, but the British would come, open up a mine, build good houses. I can tell you of good mines that have got good houses that were built. They come in, extract gold, but develop the place. That's what we want. We wouldn't want someone who would just come and maybe take honey from a beehive and destroy the beehive.
So do you have any Chinese influence in Zimbabwe?
They are there, but there's no development, to tell you the truth. I'm sorry to say that. I'm not even sorry. We need development. We need good roads. We need to go back to the sunshine country, whereby we'll be coexisting, the hospitals functioning well, schools functioning well, civil servants being paid properly.
So what was the golden era of Zimbabwe then?
The golden era of Zimbabwe, you mean the golden days I would cherish. It's those days whereby you'd walk into a hospital, instead of dying there, you come out a healthy person. You go into a school, instead of just playing in the playgrounds, in the dusty playgrounds or dilapidated playgrounds, you would get something, whereby you would go maybe into a supermarket and get everything what you want, and not cheap quality. You see, those were the golden days that we miss. You see, whereby I would go and ask for a loan from the bank, and I would be given, because I would be properly paid. There's no proper payment in Zimbabwe. A teacher is going with only $150 per month.
So if they got rid of Mugabe, would it all change or not? It's gone too far.
No, it's not going to change. It's not going to change at all. That's what I know. But he's old now.
Yeah, but I mean, if they got rid of Mugabe, would it still be bad?
It will be. It won't be. There won't be any improvement because the policy, you know, a country is ruled by your domestic policy and foreign policy. Is it friendly? You know, the old time foreign policy, whereby you would say, if someone doesn't understand me, let's fight. That doesn't work. But sitting on a round table and having a discussion, that would work. If we were to call back our friends and say,
the white people.
Yes.
Do most Zimbabweans want the white people to go back?
The rest of Zimbabweans? Yes. We were saying, let's call back our friends, sit down on a round table, and agree on certain terms. You know, when things go wrong in a family or between two friends, the only thing that can bring to an end that problem is dialogue. We sit down, we hear from the other side, and the white people hears from us. We said, then, let's take off from this note, and let's do this. That's what we are wishing for. Sitting down on a round table together, eating together, talking together, a white man's child, a black man's child, playing together, cycling together, learning together in school. That's what we wish for. Because the schools that used to be better now, if you go there, they are dilapidated. The hospitals, they are not okay. You see?
Julian Parry is back with us for a view on the world this week. He's our wonderful, wicked wind-up merchant from the world of West Country Waste Management, and he's here to talk about the threatened closure of public libraries. Hello.
Well, hello to you too, and hello to all our listeners out there. Now, this week we've heard that there's something like 800 libraries are to be closed, or there are plans to close 800 libraries. And one wonders why. The answer is, of course, that local authorities find they no longer have the money to run them because the coalition government has ordered severe cutbacks to balance the budget left by the last administration, where Gordon Brown was probably and arguably the worst chancellor this country has ever seen. Now we have the problem of what we do with public services, and the libraries are set to suffer. It's interesting to see the reactions, because the library service first started in 1850 with the Public Libraries Act, and it's had a fairly steady history since then. It was brought in by the Victorians to satisfy the need for the new leisure of the working class so that they would not be getting up to shenanigans that the middle classes didn't approve of. Such were the thoughts of how he ran society in those days. Now, of course, we run society completely differently. And instead of building services, building libraries, what we do is we destroy them. However, there have been some reactions, and in the Wirral, we are pleased to hear that they were going to close down 27 or 24 libraries, I'm sorry, and now they've decided to halt the 11 that they were going to close, and it looks like a lot of their services are to be saved. Well done for them. In Gloucestershire, of course, things are slightly different. They've found another £500,000 to save their libraries. They have a £108 million budget challenge over the next 4 years, or so they tell us, but £500,000 has saved the service, which suggests that probably £25 million would have saved it all the way across the country. Now, in North Somerset, of course, as usual, there's shenanigans going on down there, as we know. As an aside, the chairman and the president of the local Conservative Association has just been thrown out, and there are serious allegations. So goodness knows what's been going on down there. But back to the libraries. Somebody has suggested that they are replaced with mobile libraries and that they will close the ones that are least used, including, I believe, Banwell. Some wag has put onto the website that it's no wonder the Banwell isn't used. It hasn't had a lick of paint since 1960. And so the arguments roll on. Nevertheless, the really serious complaint is that the closing of the libraries represents a burning of the books. And the burning of the books has its roots in the Qin dynasty of China, when after 221 BC, when China was unified, a chancellor, Li, decided that they would suppress all other intellectualism except for the favoured Maoism, and even Confucius was outlawed, as they burned 406 alchemists, or buried them alive, I'm so sorry. Apparently another 700 followed the same fate, because two had tried to feed the emperor some pills to prolong his life. In fact, they were mercury pills, I seem to remember, which would have prolonged his life in the hereafter. Anyway, he went to burn the scholars and bury them. And the next thing, of course, is that because of that and his attack on Confucius, in fact, his own dynasty fell, which leads us to the moral of the story, which is he who proposes that which is unethical ends up with the exact opposite of his heart's desire. Now, we might look at the whole of this story and say, well, why are we doing this? And of course, the answer is the amount of money that's disappeared from the exchequer and has been given to the bankers, who this week now announce that they have made £25 billion. I'll say that again, £25 billion this year, which represents a charge of about £1,000 per household just to cover their profit. Never mind the costs, but just to cover their profit. And you wonder why the whole of society is getting poorer and poorer, and why services are being cut and things can no longer be afforded. And the answer is that a huge amount of money is pouring into the pockets of these people who stood there, handed out ridiculous loans, and have now ended up with a hand in the taxpayer's pocket, creating the huge deficit, but paying themselves up to £7 million, I heard from one senior banker the other day. And everybody is beginning to realise that they are, in fact, extracting the Michael. And perhaps the only way, and I'll say it, I've said it before, and I'll say it again, the only way to deal with this issue is to have the Chancellor and the coalition government bring in a new Moneylenders Act, which finally puts a stop to their malpractice, because if they're allowed to carry on with it much longer, they will destroy the whole of our society, including the books.
Julian Parry, thank you very much. And thank you also for sharing Plop, Parry's Law of Perversity. Can we have it once again? Because it's quite good.
Parry's Law of Perversity states, he who proposes that which is unethical shall end up with the exact opposite of his heart's desire.
There you are. You have been told. Julian Parry, thank you.
Thank you.
In a few weeks' time, we're going to bring you a very exciting weekly reading of Treasure Island with the fabulous voice of our own Malcolm Grieve, straight out of Swindon. So in the run-up to this, Alec Milne has recorded some of Robert Louis Stevenson's letters. You can find out all about the author in the Writers' Museum in Edinburgh. The museum has connections with the Robert Louis Stevenson Society, who have visited his home in Monterey, America.
The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. France and Fanny Osborne, Progress as an Author, August 1876, July 1879. Stevenson went south with Walter Simpson in August 1876. A brief stay in London, they set off from Belgium to begin the canoe voyage, which was to form the subject of RLS's first book, An Inland Voyage. The voyage began in Antwerp on 25th August and ended at Pontoise on 13th or 14th of September. In the last paragraph of An Inland Voyage, RLS wrote the much quoted words, "You may paddle all day long, but it's when you come back to nightfall and look in at a familiar room that you find love or death waiting you beside the stove, and the most beautiful adventurers are not those we go to seek." He was to find love awaiting him in the person of his future wife, Fanny Vandegrift Osborne, when he arrived at Grez sometime in September 1876. Fanny had already lived for half her life and had many and varied experiences before this first meeting with a man who was to become her second husband. Frances Matilda Vandegrift was born in Indianapolis, the capital of Indiana, the eldest of six children, five girls and one boy, of Jacob Vandegrift, a lumber merchant and dealer in real estate, and his wife, Esther Thomas Keene. She always called herself Fanny and later adopted the earlier and more aristocratic-sounding spelling of her surname, Vandegrift. In 1857, Fanny married Samuel Osborne, a handsome 20-year-old from Kentucky, who was at that time private secretary to the governor of Indiana. He was remembered by his children as a man of great kindness and charm, but he proved unsatisfactory as a husband, and over the years the marriage fell under increasing strain because of his infidelities. After brief service in the Civil War, Sam's restlessness led him to travel out to California, and then, attracted by the lure of silver mining, to move on to the mining camp of Austin in Nevada. Fanny, with her younger daughter Isabel, Belle, born in 1858, joined him there in 1864 after a difficult and hazardous journey. At Austin, and later Virginia City, under the most primitive conditions, Fanny performed wonders in housekeeping, creating a comfortable home in these rough, lawless mining towns. She learned, too, to roll and smoke cigarettes, thereafter a lifelong habit, and to fire a revolver. Sam failed to make his fortune in silver mining, and after further vicissitudes, including a period when he disappeared on a prospecting trip on Montana and was falsely reported to have been killed by Indians, the Osbornes came to San Francisco, and their son Samuel Lloyd Osborne, later known as Lloyd, was born there in 1868. Soon after, Fanny caught Sam out in fresh philanderings and returned for a year to her father's farm in Clayton, Hendricks County, Indiana. There was another reconciliation, and married life was re-established in their cottage at East Oakland across the bay from San Francisco. Sam secured a position as an official shorthand reporter in the district court. Fanny was able to enjoy a wide range of interests and activities. Her greatest joy was in gardening, but she also dabbled in photography, practiced at a rifle range, made clothes on her sewing machine, and, when the servants were away, did the cooking. She became friendly with a group of people, who were also Sam's friends, prominent in the cultural life of San Francisco. They included the artist Virgil Williams and his artist wife Dora Norton, with whom she corresponded for the rest of her life, and Timothy Reardon, a lawyer who was a librarian of a mercantile library and teased her and flirted with her. With Reardon's encouragement, she tried, not very successfully, to write stories. A more important step was to join her daughter Belle in studying art at Virgil Williams School. Bell was to show the greater talent, but Fanny did sufficiently well to gain a silver medal for drawing. Her second son, Harvey, was born in June 1871, but the marriage soon deteriorated again, and in 1875, Fanny made the decision not only to leave her husband again, but to travel with her three children to Europe, where she and Bell continue their art studies. No doubt the advantage for Bell of art instruction in Europe played some part in what seems a puzzling decision. After a brief visit to Indianapolis to see her parents, Fanny travelled to New York and to Antwerp, arriving there in August 1875. After 3 months in Antwerp, she moved on to Paris, where she and Bell enrolled as art students in the Atelier Julien. Sam seemed to have paid her an allowance throughout her stay in France, but they were often desperately poor. In April 1876, the beautiful but delicate Harvey died after a long and painful illness. Sam joined his wife in Paris and was with her when her son died, but returned to America almost immediately. Fanny, in a state of shock after Harvey's death, was worried about the health of their other son, Lloyd. She took him to Grez for 3 weeks. Several weeks passed before RLS arrived. The traditional family account is told by Fanny's sister, Nellie Sanchez, in her biography. One evening in the summer of 1876, a little party of guests at the old inn sat at dinner about the long table in the centre of the salle de manger. It was a soft, sweet evening, and the doors and windows were open. Dusk drew near, and the lamps had just been lit. Suddenly, a young man approached from the outside. It was Robert Louis Stevenson, who afterwards admitted that he had fallen in love with his wife at first sight, when he saw her in the lamplight through the open window. Sydney Colvin, December 1877. 17 Harriet Row. My book would have been done by this time if it had not fallen seedy. As it is, I have upwards of 150 pages of it done, taking 220 words to the page, which is more than I should like to see. An inland voyage, thus sang they in the English boat, Marvel. Instead of trying to finish, I shall go back in the beginning, which wants some licking, and let you have all that's done in a day or two, probably by Tuesday. About Macmillan, of course I leave everything to you with a blast of gratitude, but of course it wouldn't be possible to get Macmillan to make it a pretty book. His books are so foul to look upon. A small book like this should be in a small form, like the little 16th or 18th century books, with catchwords and the preface in italics. Now Macmillan would try to make it a big book, give me a page so ugly that shame would seize upon my heart whenever I looked at it. But of course, that's a secondary consideration. Molloy was not a canoeist. He went in for a four-oar gig. Moreover, his book was not a book. It was only illustrated. Now, my work is a true risbald. Good or bad, well done or ill, it is the history of a man's life during some weeks of travel. If you would like the title thus, An Inland Voyage, Flanders, Picardy, Ile-de-France, why, it'll be true, and I'll do anything to gratify you. I am in both Bentley and the Cornhill for January, and I've just received another proof from the latter. Quite right, my lord. Huffer's the boy. I hope he'll take it. There are good bits and bad bits in the paper, I fancy, but I could never have written it so well before. I prefer not to speak of anything but business. You may see from my hand that I'm not in the best estate. No more I am, and I cannot talk of what vexes me, or I get worse. But for one thing, the last account of F's little boy makes me think he's going the way of the other. And for another, did you ever hear of spring? As the season, I believe, follows immediately on winter. Well, spring is my term day. To Walter Crane. 16th March 1878, Burford Bridge Inn, Box Hill, Dorking, Surrey. Mr. Crane, dear sir, I hope that is the orthodox beginning. Mr. Kegan-Paul has asked me to call on you, and I have tried to do so. Owing to time and tide, that could not be, so I take the other liberty of writing. You have written to him promising a frontispiece for the fortnight hence for the little book of mine, An Inland Voyage, shortly to appear. Mr. Paul is in dismay. It appears that there is a tide of affairs in publishing which has the narrowest moments of flood conceivable. A week here, a week there, and the book is made or lost. And now, as I write to you, is the very nick of time, the publisher's high noon. I should deceive you if I were to pretend that I had no more than a generous interest in this appeal. For, should the public prove gullible to the proper degree, and 1,000 copies net, counting 13 to the dozen, disappear into its capacious circulating libraries, I should begin to perceive a royalty, which visibly affects me as I write. I fear you will think me rude, and I do mean to be importunate. The sooner I can get to the frontispiece for us, the better the book will swim, if swim it does. Believe me, yours hopefully, Robert Louis Stevenson.
Thank you very much to Alec Milne and his voice. Tim Burrows is here in the studio to voice his anger, albeit through poetry, at proposed public library closures. Hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good, good.
Okay, I understand you you confessed you had a bit of a hangover, but you're okay to read poetry?
Yes, I think I could, you know. Just
about, yeah. Okay, good. What have you got?
So this is called Who Needs a Book? It's outrage at the proposals to close the libraries, basically. Who needs a book when the bankers get their bonuses? Who needs a CD when the city makes you scream? Who needs a library when a country lost its all its new ideas? Who needs a librarian to help you find a dream? Who works so hard among the book-lined shelves? Who waits in line to take a treasure out? Who craves a little scare from Edgar Allan Poe? Who the Dickens took the cash from under Tiny Tim's hat? Who will tell the pensioner that the mobile library's gone? Who will tell the toddler that Postman Pat's been sacked? Who will tell the poet that Thomas the Rhymer's done? Who will tell the buddy artist that the art books are packed? Who says the libraries are not for cutting? Who demands that the city pays its debt instead? Who tells these stupid politicians not to pull the plug? Who knows that this is a nation cutting off its intellectual head?
We do!
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much to Tim Burrows, and we shall see you again in future weeks. Preferably wearing a red beret, I trust. Well, Jeff Sparks could not be with us this week, but he did make sure that we had a What's On guide. Good, reliable old Jeff. Well, we found a budding media personality to read out his What's On guide for him this week. I'd like to welcome to the microphone Sophia Costa.
Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday the 10th of February, The Bravery will be performing with support from Transfer and also Royal Chains at the Thekla in The Grove, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £10 in advance. On Friday the 11th of February, Caves will be performing with support from Everything We Left Behind and also Steve French and the Big Cats at The Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £2 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Shirley and Lee. The duo formed in 1950s, and this is their second single, Let the Good Times Roll.
Come on, baby, let the good time roll. Come on, baby, let me thrill your soul. Come on, baby, let the good time roll. Roll all night long. Come on, baby, yes, this is it. This is something I just can't miss. Come on, baby, let the good time roll, roll all night long.
That was The Good Times Roll, Shelley and Lee. Saturday the 12th of Feb, Pink Floyd tribute act Just Floyd, the Victoria 88, Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Finally, Sunday the 13th of Feb, Steve Payne and the Blues Cowboys will be performing at Coronation Tap, Sion Place, Bristol. Gig starts 4 p.m. and entry is free. Take care and have a great week. That's all from Jeff Sparks.
Thank you very much to Sophia Costa.
That's all from Dialect this week. Thank you to Julian Parry for his World This Week and for Lindsay Hay from the Bristol Care and Repair. The number to ring there is 0117-954-2222.
The features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. The letters of Robert Louis Stevenson were read by Alec Milne, and the poetry was by Tim Burrows. The What Song was written by Jeff Sparks, and in a sparkling debut performance was read by Sophia Costa. The engineer was Michael Noyce, and the producer was Anthea Page. The presenters were John Peters Coleman
and myself, Nick Payne.
So thank you very much to you all, and goodbye, and until next week, take care.
Kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.